Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, this time today we will study, I try to study two suttas. First, the Salayaka Sutta. This is the sutta given by the Buddha to a to the householders, Brahmin householders living in the village of Sala. Yeah, you find this on page 379 in the Middle Length Discourses. And incidentally, the Brahmin householders of Sala, these were the same people to whom the Buddha gave the discourse number 60, the Apanaka Sutta, which we discussed, it must have been about 2 months ago. Okay, so the sutta begins in the same way as the Apanaka Sutta. The Buddha is wandering on tour together with a large number of monks, and eventually he comes to the village of Sala. Then the Brahmin householders of Sala hear that the Buddha has arrived. They know about his reputation as a great enlightened master, and so they decide to come to see him, to get some advice for him. So they come to meet him, some pay homage to him, others just exchange greetings with him, others salute him in a respectful way. Some just announce their name and clan and sit down, and then some silently sit down to one side. Then, when they're seated, they ask the Buddha some questions. These are questions concerned with the principles or laws which underlie the process of re-becoming or rebirth. And this, though it might not be of great contemporary concern, is actually, in my own view, a very important topic for gaining a full, deep, and adequate understanding of the Buddha's teaching. A lot of contemporary presentations deal only with the relevance of the Buddha's teaching to our life here and now. And then they dismiss this other aspect of the teaching concerned with the laws of karma and rebirth as being just some Indian cultural baggage which the Buddha had to take along in order to make his teaching meaningful and intelligible to the people in his environment. But actually, if we really understand the Buddha's teaching and its breadth and its depth, we see that this teaching or doctrine of re-becoming and rebirth is so fundamental to so many different aspects of the teaching. That if we remove that aspect of the Dhamma, what we are left with is really just a very, very minute fraction of the original teaching. It's like pulling the bottom away from the teaching, pulling the surrounding, the setting away from the teaching. And what we're left with are just some maybe skillful and effective psychological principles, principles of mental training, which can be beneficial, but on their own, without the underlying structure of the teaching of rebirth, the law of karma, the multiplicity of lives, the vast multi-dimensions of the universe, we just see a very superficial, incomplete aspect of the teaching. Okay, and so these Brahmin householders now ask the Buddha, what is the cause and condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in states of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell? And I've also included, along with the outline of the sutta, what I call a Dharma Follower's Guide to the Universe. So if you need some help navigating yourself, your way around through the different avenues, streets, highways of samsara, this is the guide to follow. So when they speak about states of deprivation, those are basically either the three or four bad destinations which are on the chart here, the list. In the older suttas mention only three bad destinations: the hells, the animal realm, and the realm of the pretas, or unhappy spirits. Later texts add the asuras, the realm of titans, as a fourth. Okay, so then they ask, what is the cause and condition why some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world? Now, it should be noted that these inquirers are Brahmin householders, so they are not yet people who have fully accepted the Buddha as their spiritual guide. They're not yet ready to seek the ultimate liberation, deliverance. But they are concerned, they recognize their weaknesses, their obstacles, and so they are concerned to secure, to avoid the possibility of a rebirth into the bad destinations, and to secure for themselves a good likelihood of achieving a happy, fortunate rebirth. And so their question still pertains to a fortunate existence within the round of becoming, within the cycle of birth and death. They aren't yet inquiring about the way to enlightenment or liberation from the cycle of rebirth. If you remember when I began the sutta course, or in an early class, I mentioned three types of benefits that come from following the Dharma. One is the benefit visible here and now in this present life. The second is the benefit that comes in future lives. And the third is the ultimate benefit, the highest benefit, liberation. And so their questions pertain to the second benefit: how to avoid an unfortunate rebirth, how to secure a happy or fortunate rebirth. And the Buddha answers their question in two ways. First, he gives a very short, concise reply. Then they will persist and insist for elaboration, then he will give a more extensive reply. So here the Buddha first gives the concise reply. He says it is by reason of conduct not in accordance with the Dhamma, that is, conduct contrary to the fundamental moral law of the universe. It is because of unrighteous conduct that some beings here are reborn after death in the unhappy destination. And then it is by reason of conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, that is, conduct in accordance with the moral law, because of righteous conduct, that some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death are reborn in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. I just want to point out that it's become fashionable among some present-day Dharma teachers to say that when the Buddhist texts speak about rebirth, what they really mean is the arising of states of mind, particular states of mind. So when they say that when you're reborn in hell, that's just a kind of metaphor, which means when you get a really angry or tormenting state of mind, where you feel really miserable and upset, that's like, that is rebirth and hell. When the mind becomes very impulsive and, say, greedy, what's meant by being reborn as an animal. When you have intense craving for something that you can't satisfy, that's being reborn as a tormented spirit. When you have a very beautiful or lofty thought, noble, pure thought, that is rebirth as a god in heaven. When you have ordinary thoughts, that is being reborn moment by moment as a human being. And so that's the way they interpret the idea of rebirth as found in the old text. But if you look at the texts themselves, you come again and again across the expression on the dissolution of the body after death. On the dissolution of the body after death. Kayasa Beda Parang Marana. And so it's rather difficult to to interpret that in line with the idea that rebirth means the arising simply of momentary states of mind. Okay, so the Buddha first, he gives this very concise reply. Then the Brahmin householders are puzzled by it, and they say that they don't understand it, and they ask if he would give a more elaborate explanation. Okay, so now the Buddha is going to explain the type of action that is contrary to the Dhamma, unrighteous conduct, in terms of, I see I made a typing mistake twice. Three kinds of bodily misconduct. B should be four kinds of verbal misconduct. And then again, just down below, four kinds of verbal good conduct. Okay, four kinds of verbal misconduct, three kinds of mental misconduct. I know why that happened, because I used the copy and paste device. And then wasn't mindful enough to recall I had to change the three to a four in the case of speech. Yeah. Okay, so here the Buddha, well, I wanted to cover this sutta because earlier we did the 10 courses of unwholesome karma just in the form of lists or bare outlines of the items. But here the Buddha gives more elaborate explanations of what each of these entails. Okay, so now he's explaining the three kinds of bodily misconduct. First, here someone kills living beings. He is murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. So this shows the kind of character that really lies behind this first unwholesome course of karma. People are sometimes worried if they swat a fly, swat a mosquito, have to spray some insecticide to get rid of cockroaches. Oh, I'm committing some terrible, unwholesome karma. Maybe it's going to take me to hell. Of course, in accordance with the first precept, one should try to avoid any type of unnecessary killing. But one shouldn't be overly concerned if there's an almost unavoidable circumstantial necessity for eliminating some forms of relatively low life, that one is guilty of some terrible crime. Because the basic determinative factor in karma is volition, chaitanya. And so when the volition springs from somebody who is really bloody-handed, merciless, or even callous and insensitive to other living beings, then that becomes a very strong and wholesome karma. But if one has to take the life of a minor creature with a lot of regret, then the karmic force is still unwholesome, but it's much less than that of the strong, viciously motivated act of killing. Okay, second, he takes what is not given, which means he takes by way of theft the wealth and property of others in, here they use the familiar ideas of, in the village or the forest. So this, to take what is not given, is to take something that belongs to others without proper authorization. Then what is called sexual misconduct, or misconduct regarding sensual pleasures. And here I'm sure women will think, ah, this principle is explained only with regard to a man in relation to women. But one could just invert the expression in order to figure out how it applies to a woman. Okay, the man is one who has intercourse with women who are protected by their parents, brother, sister, or relatives. And in ancient India, in fact, even in India today, young girls up to the time when they are ready for marriage are always looked after very carefully by their parents. If the parents are not alive or if the parents are involved with work, they are looked after by older brothers or sisters. With those who have a husband, with those who are protected by law, who are legally off limits, and with those who are engaged to be married. I think if we were to put this into a modern context, we would have to interpret this to mean that I would say that the man who is married should not have any sexual relations outside the marriage. And then an unmarried man should not have sexual relations with a minor or with a woman who for some reason should be regarded as off limits. A woman who is engaged to another man, or a woman who has taken maybe religious vows. That's incorporated under those who are protected by law. And similarly, a woman should not have any sexual relations with outside the marital relationship. But actually, what I should say is that according to the oldest Buddhist texts, there's no statement which says that the sexual act should be take place only within a legally authorized marriage. So it would seem that if there is a mature independent man, a mature independent woman who are not committed to other partners and they want to have sexual relations with each other, then that relationship would not be a breach of this principle of karma, would not be a breach of the third precept. As long as no other third party is hurt by this, by their decision, as long as they are old enough to take on this decision for themselves, then it would seem to be not a breach of this principle of karma. Okay, then four kinds of verbal misconduct or unrighteous conduct. First, the general principle is one speaks falsehood, but then the strongest type of falsehood set against the social context of the Buddha's teaching is that when somebody is brought to a court or to a meeting or some other social function and he bears false witness against another person, saying something which will damage the reputation, the status, the good repute of some other person, or which will cause financial loss to that person. So when he has seen something, he says he has not seen it. Or if he has not seen something, he says that he has seen it. In other words, he commits perjury, he gives false incriminating testimony. Or else he, with full awareness, deliberately, he speaks falsehood for his own benefit or in some dishonest way for the benefit of another or for some trifling worldly end. All of this is the elaboration of the first principle of verbal misconduct. The second is called pisuna vacha, which means, it's translated, malicious speech. And what this means specifically is speaking something which creates divisions and disharmony among people who are united in friendly relationships. So if these people are friends, then I say something to those people there, which will eventually come back to them, and then divide those who are friends. And so this is a person who is one who divides those who are united, a creator of divisions, who enjoys discord, rejoices in discord, delights in discord, a speaker of words that create discord. The third type of verbal misconduct is harsh speech. This means speaking words that are rough, hard, hurtful to others, offensive to others, bordering on anger, and which are not conducive to concentration, which disturb the mind, distract the mind. And sometimes to be really hurtful, words don't have to be really angry or vehement, but sometimes even a very subtle, sarcastic comment could damage people's feelings worse than angry, forceful speech. Isn't that the case? Sometimes just a snide remark, even a hard, glaring look with the eyes could cause more hurt than a violent outburst of angry speech. Then the fourth is, here it's given as gossiping, but more it's idle chatter, speaking at the wrong time. Just when it's time to keep silence, the person just keeps on speaking. And he speaks what is not true, what is useless, what is against the Dharma, what is against the discipline, speaking words that are worthless, unreasonable, immoderate, and unbeneficial. Okay, these are four types of verbal misconduct. And then there are three kinds of mental misconduct. The first, as I've explained earlier, is called covetousness. But here, to become a cause of unwholesome karma, that's a very powerful type of karma which is able to lead to rebirth, it has to be actively and strongly desiring to gain possession of the wealth and property of others. It's not just the thought of greed or of lust, but it's actually wishing, planning, scheming in one's mind, longing that the possessions of somebody else will come to be one's own. The second type of misconduct, of mental misconduct, is ill will. And this is something more than just anger or resentment. But it is that anger or resentment or hatred when it becomes so strong that it comes to expression in the desire that other people will suffer misery and harm, even die because of one. Other people will suffer misery, damage, will even die. So it's the mind which comes to expression in the thoughts, may these beings be slain and slaughtered, may they cut off, perish, or be annihilated. Then the third type of unwholesome mental action is wrong view. And it's specifically the wrong view which denies the validity of moral distinctions, which denies the efficacy of the law of karma. In other words, as explained here, it's the wrong view which is expressed as the idea that there's no point in giving anything, in making donations, no point in making offerings, no point in charity. That's just all delusions of fools to see some benefit in giving. That there's no result of good and bad actions, that there are no other worlds beyond this world, no lives beyond this life, no point in serving and helping one's mother and father, no beings who are reborn in other realms, and no virtuous, wise ascetics and Brahmins who have attained some direct realization of the nature of this world and the world beyond. So those who hold such views very strongly and propagate them are violating the third principle of mental good conduct. They're adopting a very, what's called a wrong view with dangerous consequences. And those, so the Buddha sums up and he says, it is by reason of such conduct that is contrary to the Dhamma, by reason of such unrighteous conduct, that some beings here on the dissolution of the body after death reappear in states of deprivation and so on, even in hell. Okay, then the Buddha explains the courses of action that will lead to rebirth in the good destination. Here we're in paragraph 11. These will be the actions that are in accordance with the moral law, the principles of righteous conduct. And again, these are three of body, four of speech, three of mind. The three kinds of bodily good conduct. Here, someone first abandons the killing of living beings and abstains from killing living beings. Then, with rod and weapon laid aside, gentle and kindly, he abides compassionate to all living beings. In the Buddhist texts, we make a distinction with regard to ethics between two aspects of any ethical rule. We call these varita and charita. Yeah, varita, which comes from the root variti, to restrain from. Varita means avoiding the unwholesome, abstaining from the unwholesome. It's what we might call the negative side of morality. And its counterpart is charita, from the root char, charity. Shing. Shing. Which means active virtue, doing the good, cultivating good qualities, wholesome qualities. And so in this case, abandoning the killing of living beings is which of these two? Varita. And then he abides compassionate to all living beings? Charita. Okay, then the second is abstaining from taking what is not given. Here, this passage doesn't actually mention a positive quality, but the positive quality would be honesty or contentment with what one has. Then, with regard to the third principle of bodily good conduct, he abstains from misconduct and sensual pleasures. He does not have intercourse with any of the women who are protected by others and so on. But then the positive quality that corresponds to this would be, the Buddhist texts give another expression, contentment with one's own partner, or fidelity to one's own partner. That is in the case of householders, in the case of monks, of course, are those who would take religious vows, would be observing celibacy. Okay, then there are four kinds of verbal good conduct. First, on the side of abstinence or avoidance, one abandons false speech, abstains from false speech. And then when one is summoned to a court or so on, when one is questioned as a witness, then one speaks the truth. One will always say what one has seen, what one has known, and will not fabricate stories in order to hurt or damage others. So we could say here the varita is to avoid speaking falsehood. The charita, or positive side of the principle, is speaking the truth. Okay, the second principle, one abandons malicious speech. One does not speak words which will divide friends and create discord and disharmony. And then the text mentions the positive side, the side of charita. He is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, who speaks words that promote concord. Then third, he abandons harsh speech, abstains from harsh speech. That is the principle, the side of varita, of avoidance. Then the positive side, the side of cultivating wholesome qualities, is that one speaks words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, but not flattery, which is, in a sense, a type of unwholesome speech. So one speaks words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable, words which win the hearts of people, words that are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. Then the fourth principle of verbal good conduct, first, by way of avoidance, one abandons gossip or idle chatter. Then on the side of positive virtue, one speaks at the right time. When it is the time to speak, then one speaks. When it's the time to be silent, then one keeps silent. One speaks what is factual, speaks on what is good, speaks about the Dharma and the discipline. One speaks words that are worth recording. Even in the time of the Buddha, there must have been tape recordings. But people had minds that were trained to retain what they heard, so they were perhaps more accurate than tape recordings. He speaks words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Words that are connected with promoting the good of others. So that is four types of good, wholesome verbal conduct. Then there are the three kinds of mental good conduct. Three wholesome qualities of mind. Actually, the first one is given almost only negatively. that one is not covetousness and does not covet the wealth and property of others. But I would say more positively, one could give as a more powerful wholesome karma corresponding to covetousness the thought of generosity, of giving, of charity, of wishing to help others through gifts. Okay, then the second, that one develops a mind without ill will, and one cultivates the thoughts, may these beings be free from enmity, free from affliction, free from anxiety, may they live happily. In other words, these are, one develops thoughts of loving kindness or metta. And then the third type of wholesome mental conduct is right view. And the minimal right view is the right view that affirms the validity of moral distinctions, which affirms the efficacy, karmic efficacy of wholesome action. So this is expressed as the view that there is value in giving, in making offerings, in practicing charity. There is fruit and results of good and bad actions. There is this world and the world beyond this world. There is value in serving one's parents. There are beings who are reborn spontaneously in other realms. And there are wise, virtuous ascetics who have understood through their direct knowledge the nature of this world and the world beyond. And so it is, the Buddha concludes, it is by reason of this type of conduct, which is in accordance with the Dhamma, this type of righteous conduct, that some beings here after death, on the dissolution of the body after death, are reborn in the happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Okay, and now the Buddha is going to sort of cap the discourse by showing the benefits that come from observing this wholesome, righteous conduct, by showing the different realms of existence towards which one can direct the mind through the power of one's wholesome actions. Because as long as we are not yet liberated from the defilements, the mental fetters, we're going to take rebirth in one realm of existence or another. And so what the Buddha teaches is that the mind, energized and fueled by wholesome karma, can be used as an instrument for directing the stream of consciousness onwards to its next mode of existence. And one does this by forming a righteous wish for a happy mode of rebirth. Okay, so one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma might wish that on the dissolution of the body after death, may I be reborn in the company of well-to-do Brahmins. Of course, he's speaking against the background of the Indian society of his time. So people, the privileged classes were the Brahmins. Actually, if the nobles come first. Oh, right, I'm sorry, I jumped the gun. It should be paragraph 15. He forms the wish, may I be reborn after death in the company of well-to-do Kshatriyas or nobles. In the Buddha's time, the two privileged classes were the Kshatriyas, who were the administrators, the warriors, the nobles, and the Brahmins. The Brahmins considered themselves to be the top class and the Kshatriyas to be subordinate to themselves. The Kshatriyas, from which community the Buddha himself came, considered themselves to be the superior class and the Brahmins to be subordinate to them. And so the Buddhist texts consistently put the nobles ahead of the Brahmins, whereas Brahminic texts will put the Brahmins ahead of the Kshatriyas. Okay, so the first three realms of rebirth to which one can direct the consciousness are three successful or prosperous states within the human realm, either as prosperous nobles, prosperous Brahmins, or prosperous householders. And then the text says, if one does so, it is possible that after death one will be reborn in accordance with one's wish. It's not guaranteed, but if one has that desire, then one also needs sufficient store of merit or wholesome karma to fulfill the wish, to fulfill the aspiration. Okay, so it's possible that the wish might be fulfilled. And why is that? Because this person observes conduct that is in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. And now the text takes us on a kind of tour of the different celestial realms of existence. And here we should turn to the second page in which we have this guide to the universe. Guide to the different realms of existence. And the various celestial realms fall into three broad categories. First, the lowest are the celestial realms within the sense, or celestial planes within the sensual desire realm. These will be the heavenly realms in which the gods there, the celestial beings, enjoy heavenly sense pleasures. There's still strong sensual desire, but the lifespan is very long. The pleasures are very pure and intense. The beings are very beautiful, free from the grosser types of misery and suffering that we have in the human realm. So we have the heaven of the four great kings. This is a relatively low type of heaven, barely higher than the human realm. Then above this, there's the gods of the 33, the Tavatinsa Devas, these are the gods who enjoy very intense sensual pleasures. They live in beautiful parks. They have beautiful groves. The male devas have beautiful female partners. The female devas have beautiful male partners. And they delight in sensual pleasures day and night. Above this are the Yama gods. The texts say almost nothing about them. Very, very little. Above the Yama gods are the two-seater devas, contented gods. This seems to be a more refined heavenly realm. This is supposed to be the heavenly realm in which a bodhisattva before his final rebirth on earth takes place, lives and teaches the Dhamma. So it's said that now Maitreya bodhisattva, the future Buddha, is now dwelling in the Tusita Deva Loka, awaiting the time for his rebirth into the human realm. So I would think that there's probably much more serious Dhamma teaching and Dhamma practice in the Tusita Deva world than in the Tavatinsa Deva world. Then there's a type of god called Nimana Rati Deva. Oh, I see the typing mistake. Rati, there should be a T there. Rati, instead of an I, instead of two I's, R-A-T-I. These are called gods who delight in emanations or creations. I imagine that the beings who get reborn in this world will be those who, as human beings, have been great artists, great musicians, creators of great aesthetic works. Then the gods who control the emanations of others, maybe these will be the people, those human beings who have been publishers, editors, or directors of copyrights, patents. Okay, then, above the six sense-sphere heavens, we now come to a whole new dimension, which is called the form realm, or the realm of subtle matter. Now the heavenly realms, the six heavenly realms, these can be reached simply through a sufficient store of strong, wholesome karma. By generosity, by moral observance, by having good mental qualities, like kindness, compassion, sympathy with others. Those mental qualities, and even lower states of meditation, that is sufficient to bring rebirth into the heavenly realm. But to pass beyond the heavenly realms to the form realm, one has to achieve at minimum the first meditative absorption, that was called the first jhana. The jhana, where the mind becomes collected, concentrated, fully absorbed in an object. In that meditative attainment, the mind is actually making a quantum leap to a new dimension of mental activity. It is a dimension of mental activity which has its proper objective counterpart in the Rupa Dhatu, the realm of subtle matter, or the realm of form. So a meditator in the human realm who achieves one or another of the jhanas and masters that jhana so that he has access to the attainment whenever he wants through the course of life, and doesn't lose that attainment at the time of death, can then mobilize the mind in such a way that when rebirth takes place, the mind will pass entirely beyond the sense sphere realms of existence and take rebirth in the form realm, in which there's none of the grosser types of sensory experience, but most of the time the brahmas, or inhabitants of the form realm, pass their time in deep meditative absorption, enjoying the bliss and tranquility of the jhanas. And then according to the way of systematizing the realms of rebirth that come in the Buddhist Abhidharma text, okay, one who gains and masters the first jhana, depending upon the degree of mastery of the jhana, can be reborn in one of these three planes in the Brahma world. If there's an inferior degree of mastery, one gets reborn as a member of Brahma's assembly. If one gains a medium degree of mastery, then one becomes one of the inner circle of Brahma's court. In other words, one becomes one of the ministers of Brahma. And if one gains superior mastery of the jhana, then one takes rebirth as a great Brahma, one of the powerful deities in that realm. then if one goes beyond the first jhana, one attains the second jhana. There are three possible degrees of mastery: inferior, middling, and superior, and that will give access to one of these three realms of radiance, either the realm of limited radiance, the realm of measureless radiance, or the realm of streaming radiance. Even though the sutta speaks about the gods of radiance, as well as the gods of limited radiance, gods of immeasurable radiance, gods of streaming radiance, but according to the commentary, the expression gods of radiance is intended only not to indicate a separate realm of existence, but as a general term which comprises the three more specific types of radiant deities. Okay, if one passes beyond the second jhana and one attains the third jhana, masters that jhana, and retains that jhana through to the time of death, then one can direct the mind at death to rebirth in still another dimension, higher dimension of being, the realms of glory. If there's an inferior mastery of the third jhana, one will be reborn in the realm of limited glory. If one gains a medium degree of mastery, one gets rebirth in the realm of measureless glory. And if one gains the highest degree of mastery, one gets reborn in the realm of refulgent glory. See, I did this rather quickly this morning. Refulgent glory should be number three. Okay, then if one gains the fourth jhana, one gets reborn amongst what are called the gods of great fruit. That's the normal mode of rebirth. But then there's a type of being called a non-percipient being. These are beings who don't have any perception, any mental activity. This is not considered, from the Buddhist standpoint, this is not considered a desirable sphere of rebirth. But it seems that some of the other Indian schools contemporary with the Buddha, their followers aim for rebirth into this realm. And so the Buddha had to include it within his cosmology. To get reborn into that realm, one masters the fourth jhana, and then one makes a determination that one wants mind and mental activity to cease. And then as a result of that determination, one will be reborn in a realm where there is no perception, no feeling, no mental activity. Okay, now those disciples of the Buddha who reach the third level of enlightenment, the third of the four levels of enlightenment, are not yet completely liberated from the round of rebirth, but they gain access to rebirth in certain realms which will not admit anybody else. Only those who become non-returners, anagamis, disciples at the third stage of enlightenment, the third of the four stages of enlightenment, will be admitted to rebirth into these five pure abodes. If anybody else tries to get admitted, there's a big tough bouncer standing at the door who says, "Show me your card." And if they can't produce a card which says anagami, non-returner, the bouncer says, "Get away, you don't belong here." So these five realms are differentiated according to the strength of the spiritual faculties of the disciples. But once one gains rebirth into the pure abode, then one doesn't come to rebirth anywhere else within samsara. One remains in the pure abodes until one achieves final liberation. Okay, then coming back to the human realm, now the human meditator can develop concentration or meditative, can develop meditation beyond the jhanas, can attain four stages of meditative absorption, which are called the formless or immaterial attainments. I think I've discussed these already very briefly. These are called the base of infinite, of the infinity of space, the base of the infinity of consciousness, the base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. And if one attains one of these states in the human realm and masters that attainment, then at the time of death, one will take rebirth into the corresponding formless state, formless realm. These four formless realms are not considered very desirable from the Buddhist standpoint, because when one gets reborn into these realms, the lifespan is extremely long, thousands and thousands of aeons. And there's not much possibility of spiritual progress there. But for non-Buddhist meditators, these realms of rebirth have been considered extremely desirable. In fact, from the Buddhist standpoint, one would say that the meditators who achieved these states misinterpreted them as final liberation, as nirvana. So when they would achieve, for example, the base of nothingness, the base of neither perception nor non-perception, because there's no form or material substance there, just pure consciousness floating on its own, they would think, I have done it, I've completed the job, I am liberated from all rebirth. And the lifespan there goes thousands and thousands of aeons. And so even when they're dwelling in that realm, they won't have any idea that they're still in bondage. They would think, I'm dwelling in nirvana. This is the highest. This is the supreme. Until the clock goes ticking, ticking, ticking. One great aeon, two, three, 999. What it goes up to, I think, 84,000 great aeons. Then you pass aeon 83,000 has passed, down to one more great aeon, then to the years, months, weeks, days, minutes, seconds, fifth, 84,000 aeons are over. Time to pass away and take rebirth elsewhere. And then they fall away and they realize, alas, that they made a mistake in evaluation of their attainment. Okay, so rebirth in all of these realms, according to the Buddha, depends upon observing conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct. In other words, it depends upon following the 10 courses of wholesome karma. The 10 courses of wholesome karma by themselves are not sufficient to bring rebirth into the form realm or the formless realm. To gain those types of rebirth, one needs also the force of either the jhanas or the formless meditation. But without the 10 courses of wholesome karma, rebirth into these realms is impossible. In fact, without the courses of wholesome karma, it would not be possible even to succeed in practicing for the jhanas as a human being. Because those 10 courses of wholesome karma, those are the supporting ethical observances which contribute to the success in the meditative attempt to gain the jhanas. But the aim of the Buddha's teaching is not rebirth into one or another realm of existence, even these lofty realms of existence. And so in the last paragraph, the Buddha says, if, householders, one who observes conduct in accordance with the Dhamma, righteous conduct should wish, oh, that by realization for myself with direct knowledge, I might here and now enter upon and dwell in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless or undefiled with the destruction of the defilement. It is possible that by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge, he will here and now enter upon and abide in the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom that are taintless with the destruction of the taints. In other words, if one is observing the 10 courses of wholesome action and one wishes to achieve final liberation, ultimate liberation, or nirvana, here and now, then that is conceivable, that is possible. Again, because these 10 courses of wholesome action are the foundation, the necessary supporting conditions for the attainment of final liberation. But again, they are not, in themselves, they are not sufficient, but to bring final liberation, the 10 courses of wholesome action have to be completed first through sufficient concentration or samadhi, and then through the development of panya or prajna, insight or wisdom, the wisdom which discerns, which investigates and penetrates the true nature of things. And so then at the conclusion, the Brahmin householders salute the Buddha and express their appreciation. Okay, then I wanted to take very briefly another sutta along a similar theme called the Sankhar Upapatti Sutta. This is page 959 in the Majjhima Nikaya. In this sutta, the Buddha says, he tells the monks that I'm going to teach you how to be reborn in accordance with your aspiration or in accordance with your volition. That is how you can volitionally control the course of rebirth. Okay, and here since he's talking to the monks, he speaks in terms of a monk, but I think this can apply to any follower. What's important are the qualities which are enumerated. Here, a monk possesses faith, virtue, learning. In the fourth, chaga can mean either generosity or also detachment, renunciation, and wisdom. Then he thinks, oh, that on the dissolution of the body after death, I might reappear or be reborn in the company of well-to-do nobles, kshatriyas. So this is the wish. There are the qualities, the wish. Then he fixes his mind on that, resolves upon it, and develops it. And these aspirations and this abiding of his, thus developed and cultivated, lead to his reappearance or rebirth there. This is the path, the way that leads to reappearance there. In other words, the way to rebirth as a well-to-do noble. Then the same, it's repeated for Brahmins, householders, then for rebirth amongst into any of the celestial or heavenly realms. And here, indeed, controlling or mastering the course of rebirth, two main factors are necessary. I distinguish them as the fuel and the engine. The fuel are the five qualities: faith, virtue, learning, generosity, and wisdom. We might even add a third determinant here. We call this the steering wheel, maybe it will be the wish for rebirth into a particular realm. Then the engine will be fixing the mind on that realm, resolving the mind, not revolving the mind, resolving the mind, developing the mind. And then one directs the mind towards the particular type of rebirth. The directing of the mind, that is the steering wheel. And if there is sufficiently strong faith, virtue, learning, and so on, and if one has consistently fixed the mind and resolved the mind on that realm, wishing to be reborn in a particular realm, then it is very possible that one will be reborn in accordance with your wish. Then this is explained in elaborate way with regard to different Brahma realms. You could read the sutta, I won't explain. Then it goes through all the different planes of existence in the realm of form. Then unto the formless planes, the sphere of infinite space, infinite consciousness, and so on. And then it ends in the same way that one directs the mind to realizing for oneself here and now with direct knowledge, the deliverance of mind, deliverance by wisdom through the destruction of the defilement. And then one might realize for oneself that liberation of mind. So in other words, all of these higher attainments, from higher rebirth to liberation, depend upon these five fueling factors and the fixing, resolving, and developing of the mind in the appropriate mode. And maybe some people have the question, two questions. First, to practice Buddhism, is it really necessary to believe in all of these realms? The answer is no. Well, maybe not so literally. I think it's good to believe in the reality of rebirth, the law of karma, and to see these realms as possibilities that correspond to qualities of consciousness that we can experience for ourselves here and now. But if somebody is skeptical and doubtful about the existence of these realms, I wouldn't show him to the door and say, find another religion. Don't you don't really have hope, as much hope as a Buddhist. What I would say simply is, if you don't really believe these realms, for now, don't worry about it very much. Just Base yourself on what you can see and experience for yourself here and now. The benefits that come from leading a wholesome way of life, developing a wholesome state of mind, trying to cultivate true wisdom and understanding. But I would add, don't dismiss these realms out of hand just because you can't experience them now. just like somebody who is told something about relativity theory or quantum theory and says, this is all nonsense. What do you mean this is a solid object? Physicists can't tell me that this is 90% empty space. Why, if I kick it, I'll hurt my foot. So one shouldn't dismiss what one can't understand. I said that there were two questions that you might have. First was, do we really have to believe in these things to follow Buddhism? And I say, not necessarily. The second question you might be asking, does he really believe in these things, in these realms? I have to say, I don't know. What I would say is that some of the accounts that I read in the Buddhist texts say about the details of the hells, the heavenly realms, do seem like exercises in the imagination based on what I would call extrapolation from human experiences. So I don't know how literally they should be taken in all detail, but I think that something like this is probably very true and real. That there will be lower realms of existence in which acts of extremely vicious, cruel, mean types of behavior will bring about their appropriate consequences. I can't see how somebody, say, who is responsible for the cruel deaths of hundreds, thousands, even millions of people, will get away with the great amount of suffering they have caused for others, except through rebirth in some realm of great misery and suffering. And I don't see how somebody who has undergone great self-sacrifice for the welfare of others, somebody who has, say, worked very hard to promote the welfare and happiness of others, somebody who has even sacrificed their own life for the good of others, might reap some other results apart from a very blissful, happy, heavenly type of rebirth. So I would think that there are realms of existence in which the different types of actions that people perform will bring about their appropriate fruits. But what is important from the Buddhist standpoint is that, first, the two things, that there is this law of moral causation, karmic causation, according to which all of our karmic actions bring the appropriate results in one or another realm of existence, in some future realm of rebirth. The second important principle is that all realms of existence, even the most blissful, the most tranquil, the most long-lasting, are impermanent, pervaded by a subtle unsatisfactoriness or suffering, and are empty of any kind of substantial selfhood. In other words, they are all anicca, dukkha, anatmya, impermanent, suffering, not self. Okay, that was rather long distribution. I tried to squeeze in a lot. But if there are any questions... Yeah. It means makes it, paveteti, it makes it known. Yeah. Explains its nature. That's the way I would understand. Yeah. It sounds rather awkward in English. Yeah, it does to me too. Paveteti. Yep. Okay. It comes from the root vid, which means to know. It's a causative, to make known. Yeah. One might even use the word reveals if it didn't bring along connotations of revelation. But reveals is actually quite inadequate rendering. Yeah, Jim. Yeah. Yeah, the word here is devas. And when you come across the word gods, one shouldn't take them to be gods in the sense of immortal beings or creator beings. They are just living beings who have an exceptionally long lifespan, and they enjoy great bliss, great power, but they're not gods in the sense of theistic religion. As a human being, it is said to be possible that one who develops the jhanas, the meditative absorptions, particularly if one gains the fourth jhana, one can then use that mind to investigate the other realms of existence. And so one will see them just as, well, with a television set and the appropriate electrical outlet, one could put on the television set and see the programs that are taking place on channel 2, 4, 5, whatever. That's one of the types of direct knowledge, is direct knowledge of the different planes of existence. It's exercised by the specific type of direct knowledge called the divine eye, dibhachakku. Through first one gains the fourth jhana, masters it, then with the divine eye, one radiates a kind of light through one's field of meditative vision, and one makes the determination that light will show the various planes of existence. And then when the faculty of the divine eye is mature enough, then the other realms will appear before one's inner mental vision. But also it's said in the text that the Buddha and some of the great disciples were able to physically transport their bodies into these other realms in order to meet the devas there, the gods there, and to converse with them. Yeah. I think very definitely so, yeah. This is my belief. I don't have a direct knowledge of this, but I think that these will be the mainly earth-dwelling devas. There are devas that dwell not in the very remote heavenly worlds, but in close proximity to the human realm. And they're able to witness events going on in our world, though we don't see what's going on in their realm. And they, or at least some of them, belong to the class of what are called Dhamma protecting devas. Their job is to protect the Dhamma in the human realm and to protect sincere practitioners of the Dhamma. And so if one leads a very upright, virtuous life in accordance with the Dhamma, and especially if one shares one's merits with these devas, as when one does a regular liturgy or service, at the end one should, or at the end of the day perhaps, or after a meditation session, one shares the merits with the devas. As I recite the verses, I'll say we have to make photocopies of those verses. We have to get their help. One shares the merit with the devas, and they rejoice in these merits because this is helpful to them. And then they will protect us in this world to the best of their ability. They have the ability to ward off calamities, disasters, to somehow to manipulate subtle courses of events so that things work out to our favor, in our favor. So they're not all powerful, not almighty by no means, but they are like hidden benefactors, invisible benefactors that can help us in times of trouble. Does anybody have first-hand experience with them? I'm not saying asking this jokingly, but sometimes people have experience with something, like some impending calamity is about to take place. And then suddenly, just inexplicably, something, the course of events shifts. And, excuse me? Like in fact, they are guardian angels. That's what other religions speak of guardian angels. These will be the protective deities. And I guess I'm pretty sure that we speak about the Dharma protecting devas who will protect Buddhist practitioners, but followers of other religions will also have their protective devas. So, for example, Catholics who pray to the Virgin Mary, sometimes even they will have visions of the Virgin Mary. And the children, there's the famous one, Fatima in Portugal, or at Lourdes, Bernadette. You could understand that these are protective deities connected in somehow with the Catholic religion. And they appear to innocent and pure-minded individuals. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you need those five qualities as necessary conditions. But to appear in the Brahma realm, one needs, besides those five qualities, one needs the meditative absorption, the jhanas. To appear in the formless realms, one needs the formless attainment. To attain liberation, deliverance, one needs, besides those five qualities, well, one needs the wisdom, the punya, has to be developed to that highest level, to the supreme level. No, definitely. In fact, the formless realms generally should be avoided. I think perhaps the Buddha is doing this first just to show that it's possible. And also for the simple fact that, at least with some of the forms of rebirth, that we're not yet all ready to get to gain final liberation in this very life. So we have to consider that we are going to be reborn. And so we should be able to direct the consciousness towards some favorable state of rebirth. Yeah, that's why some of these realms seem to be not so conducive to final liberation, particularly in the formless realm, even some of the long-lived Brahma realms. I don't see them as...
The most conducive realm, especially the human realm, for final liberation is all Buddhas.
All Buddhas appear in the human realm. I'm betting my money on the two-seater Deva. No, that's not the case, actually. Because as I read the text, Devas in some of the heavenly realms also are present when the Buddha gives discourses. They hear the discourses and they gain the insight or penetration of the Dhamma. In other words, they enter upon the first stage, the first path and fruit of enlightenment from the Deva realm. It's true that a Buddha arises only in the human realm. But it's not true that one can enter upon the first stage of enlightenment only in the human realm. One could do so from the Deva realms, from the Brahma realms, but not from the formless realms, not from the unconscious or non-percipient realm.
isn't it true that if you
yeah.
The other realms, heavenly realms, do not have those conditions where I even practice the path.
Yeah.
And in fact, it is still the human realm that is most.
That's probably true.
Okay, I got one. So it is okay to aspire to be in the human realm while not having achieved final liberation yet.
Yeah, but I'm wondering. Okay, like all of the great masters of the past, from where is Acharya Buddhaghosa, Acharya Dhammapala, Acharya Nagarjuna, Acharya Sangha, Vasubandhu, Santarakshita, Shu Yun. He actually was to be reborn in the Tusita, in the Yenakorta. Yeah, he died almost, I think, 119. For those who don't know, he was a very famous Chan or Zen master in China. He died, I think it was 1959, at the age of 119. But after the communist takeover of China, probably 10 years earlier, 9 years earlier, he was beaten by communist rebels so badly that it seemed that he had died. And he'd reported, well, after being these Chinese communists, they beat him so badly, they saw him lying there, not breathing anymore, no more pulse. And so then they became afraid and they abandoned him as dead. But then after some time he recovered consciousness and then came back to full awareness. Then he reported that during that period when he was left for dead, he experienced his mind sort of separating from the body, and he went to the inner court of the Tusita heaven and took his place in the inner court. It was presided over by the Bodhisattva Maitreya, the future Buddha. And he wanted to find a seat, but there was no there was no seat for him. And he was wondering, why can't I get a seat? Then Maitreya told him, your time is not yet finished. And so he had to come back to the human realm, and then he regained consciousness. Any other questions? Anything that might really lie within my ability to answer? Okay, then we will stop for tonight. And next week, we take some more down to earth. I think we've had enough of these high flown celestial realms. Let us see if we can get the two sutras in next week. These will be very down to earth, realistic, practical, pragmatic, ethically upright, non speculative, non conjectural, non dogmatic, non ethereal sutras. On such humble, mundane virtues as right speech and patience. The shorter discourse to Rahula, and then the simile of the two-handled saw, Kakachupama Sutta. Okay, we'll try to get both in next week. I'm not going to end this. Yes, we have to get some. Sutta 61 and 21. And I might even take a quick look at number 58, just one paragraph. Okay. Ready, guys? Oh, turn the radio down up there. We're going to do it. Akasata Sivumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanam. Akasata Sivumata Deva Naga Mahidika Punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu desanang. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahidika. Punyantang anumodipa chirang rakantu mankaram. One more. Etavatacha mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabe devanumodantu sabasampati siddhya. Etavatacha mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabe bhutanumodantu sabasampati siddhya. Etavatacha mehi sampadang punya sampadang sabe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya vichi hetato etantare satakayupapana rupi arupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin.